From 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS Radio Waterloo. I'm here to do an interview for 12 o'clock.
All right.
And thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today there, Jane. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you asking me to. Now we'll see if it's worth your time.
I bet it will be, for sure. Now, I did have one of my viewers ask me a question. So some of these questions are from our viewers as well as myself. So one of the questions that one of my viewers asked was, how would you characterize the state of race relations in the U.S. today?
Absolutely dreadful. And the fact that we have nominated for the presidency a man who says the ugly things that he does about all those who are different from himself, which is everybody on the face of the earth, that people in this country would nominate him for the presidency says something really ugly about race relations in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm horrified too. Like, I know what Donald Trump, the one thing I'm very...
Somebody's trying to call me, so you're going to get a lot of these little noises. Don't worry about them.
Okay, but no worries. I just wanted to mention here that, I'm very frustrated with Donald Trump and the American political system, as well as our own Canadian political system, with the way that minorities have actually been treated over the years. In fact, I was also going to make a mention here that if tensions are still high after so many years, what do you think drives this unresolved conflict with so much endless energy against racism, discrimination, homophobia, ignorance, all that stuff?
It's education. We have these kids from the age, in the United States, we have them from the age of 3 to the age of 18. Now, from the age of 3 to 18, if we couldn't do a better job in 15 years of teaching students about the fact that we're all members of the same race, and it is total ignorance to treat people positively or negatively based on the physical characteristics over which they have no control. If we can't get that across to students in 15 years, there's something very wrong with our ability to educate.
I totally understand for sure. It's like when it comes to the education, I have to say that one of the things that when I was a student in school was they didn't really touch a lot on racism. Like, they didn't really touch on that as much. And I feel like a lot of the education is put by folks of non-minority race. In fact, I was watching one of your Oprah documentary series, and every person's great-great-great-great-great-parent was actually black. I heard that on Oprah.
That's right. And you need to realize that racism is part of the hidden curriculum. When I was in college, we were told, do not teach in opposition to the local mores. The people who are paying your... Hello, are you still there?
I'm still there, yes.
Okay, the people who are paying your wages through their taxes have the right to expect their students to learn what they want them to learn. So what he was saying is, if you're teaching in a racist community, you do not teach in opposition to racism. That's bad education. We've done a bad job of educating educators. Unfortunately, we don't educate educators. We condition teachers.
Teachers,
how to get these kids ready to pass the test. But we teach the 3 R's of reason, we teach 3 R's of reading, writing, and arithmetic. We forget to teach the 3 R's of reason, rights, and responsibility. And you do that for 13 years, and then at the end of 13 years, you expect them to go out into the world and be rational, logical, accepting human beings. Can't happen. We've got to change what happens in the schools. Now somebody's going to call in and say, but don't you think it's on the, that is the responsibility of the parents? No, the parents aren't getting paid to do this job. The educators are. The schools are. We put a tremendous amount of money into our education system, and it indeed becomes an indoctrination system instead of an education system. Educators lead people out of ignorance. That's not what we're doing in the schools where racism, sexism, ageism, homophobia, and ethnocentrism are concerned. We are perpetuating ignorance, and in some cases, we are deliberately making students ignorant by teaching them lies.
And I totally agree. Like, I was watching your documentary, The Eye of the Storm, And I know you are asking students about, like, you know, are the blue-eyed students better than the brown-eyed students? Like, you are teaching these exercises, and, you know, and I remembered one of the students said that they were being made fun of for having brown eyes. And I was watching that documentary. Now, I really like the way that you actually teach the students. I mean, you know, I wish we had more educators like yourselves on that as well. Now, did you have any backlash from other teachers or staff when you actually did these exercises?
Oh, yeah. I went down to the teacher's lounge the first time I did the exercise. I was just sick at what my students were doing to one another. So I went down to the teacher's lounge at noon to share with the other 2 third grade teachers what was going on in my classroom the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. When I finished telling them, and there were a number of teachers in the lounge, including the other 2 third grade teachers, when I finished telling them what was going on, the younger of the two said, and she's about 54, I guess, "I don't know how you have time for all that extra stuff. It's all I can do is teach reading, writing, and arithmetic." Well, she hadn't taught reading, writing, and arithmetic yet, as far as I could see. She might as well have been doing the extra stuff. The other one said, over 60 years old, had been molding young minds for over 30 years. And she said on the day Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, "I don't know why you're doing that. I thought it was about time somebody shot that son of a bitch." No teacher frowned. No teacher said, "Helen, how could you say a thing like that?" Every one of those teachers either smiled or laughed and nodded, because she evidently had expressed their feelings perfectly, and as the most senior member of the group, she had the most right to do so.
Oh, absolutely. And I was also going to say as well that I know right now with the province of Ontario, Canada's education system, there was, I think around 2012, teachers were going on strike for like collective bargaining rights, and they were refusing to do any extracurricular activities and stuff like that. And, you know, I feel as though that our school system needs teachers like yourself.
Well, if you want to upset the system, I'm a hard teacher for insecure principals and superintendents to get along with. Secure principals and superintendents, be they male or female, have no problem with me.
Absolutely. And I have to say that what I found myself, that when it comes to like, you know, ignorance and discrimination and everything, is that, I mean, you know, we all have a part to play in trying to combat that as well. Now, I also wanted to ask as well that I also heard that yesterday Commissioner William Bratton is stepping down from the NYPD. Now, a number of NYPD officers, most of them minorities, questioned the stop and frisk program and how they had arrest and summons quotas, and 12 of the officers filed lawsuits. Now, what advice do you have for the NYPD Police Department to stop the stop and frisk program, since it's unconstitutional by the state since 2010?
Well, they can have stop and frisk without having it be racially profiling. But it's racial profiling. You know it, I know it, they know it, but we don't want to admit it. We've got to retrain the people who are in law enforcement in this country. We've got to, if they would all just read Robert Wald Sussman's book, The Myth of Race, people would understand how badly they have been misled for 500 years and would talk themselves out of going along with this nonsense, just as they have talked themselves into going along with this nonsense. It's nonsense. There's only one race. We don't have 3 or 4 or 5 different races on the face of the earth. There's only one. But we have lived with this myth for 500 years. It is as ridiculous as thinking that the sun is a god in a golden chariot that flies across the sky every morning. It makes no sense. And if you read Sussman's book, if you had any doubt about it before, you won't have again. We need to retrain people who are in law enforcement and who are in education to see every person as an equally human being. I'm not saying that we're all equal. I know people say, "Oh, yes, we are." No. In the eyes of God, we are, but I talk to God a lot. Sometimes I hope God isn't listening and isn't watching. However, I work with fallible human beings all day, every day, and I know that in the United States of America, we have been trained to believe, indoctrinated in the belief that white people are superior to people of other color groups. It's nonsense.
I 100% agree. And what was the name of that book again, if I may ask?
Oh, the myth of race.
The myth of race.
Yeah, the myth, M-Y-T-H, of race. And the author's name is Robert Wald, W-A-L-D, Sussman, S-U-S-S-M-A-N.
Robert Wald Sussman.
Yeah, you can argue with it, but you can't argue with it because it makes good sense. I would advise every person that is hearing this radio program to get a copy of that book and read it. And if you don't want to read the whole thing, if you don't want to invest in the book, just turn to the last paragraph of the last chapter in that book and read that paragraph.
Now, is this book all...
Go on.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to ask, is this book also available on Google Books?
I haven't looked on Google Books. I suppose it is. I'm sure it's available on Amazon. I don't know. But however you have to get it, get the book.
Exactly.
Go down to the bookstore and stand there. I see people do this all the time. And just read the last paragraph in the last chapter.
And I 100% agree with that. I should look into that book myself as well. And I was also going to ask as well, because I know I have had some viewers that have complained to me about being faced with being victims of discrimination. And I wanted to ask that, what kind of proof does one need to claim discrimination? Because I know in Canada and the UK, it's more subtle forms of discrimination. So if someone's a victim of it, whether in the school system, which I've been a victim of it too in the school system myself, or let's say you're out in the community or whatever, you've been a victim of a hate crime or something, what kind of proof? Because they always ask for proof.
Well, in this country, they've passed legislation that says you have to prove a racist or sexist or ageist intent in order to win a lawsuit against someone for that kind of behavior. Now, you can't know what's in a person's mind, but if you have to know what's in their mind in order to win the lawsuit, obviously there's no sense filing, because you can't know what's in a person's mind. You can only know what happened. What you have to do is document what happened, not what you think happened, not what you think the person may have been thinking, but what you saw happen, what you experienced, and hopefully have someone there who witnessed the whole thing. You write down exactly what happened, have that witness sign it, and then if you get several of those, then you can take those and use them as evidence.
Absolutely, and I...
You have to document this stuff. You can't just say, he doesn't like me because I'm black, number one. He doesn't like me because I'm Navy. He doesn't like me because I'm yellow. No, that's not the reason people don't like you. They don't like you because of their ignorance. But every time a person of color says, that person doesn't like me because of my color, the person of color is taking the responsibility for being a person of color. Instead of forcing the person who doesn't like them, make that person take the responsibility for their ignorance about skin color.
I totally agree, and also as well, I know in Ontario, we have what we call the Human Rights Commission, where if anybody has been discriminated, and it only applies to like goods or services or employment or anything of that nature, people can actually go to the Ontario Human Rights Commission website and file a complaint, and they can have access to a lawyer from there at no charge.
And does it work?
And to be truthful, it depends. I one time called an Ontario Human Rights Commission person, and they ended up saying that the cases do take a long time. So in that case, here sometimes they'll say to file it, sometimes they'll say not to file it. So I will say that from what I've heard, it does work, but at the same time, I don't really know because that's the other person's perspective.
And what they'll do, many times what they do is draw it out for so long that you finally just give up. And that's what they're depending on.
And why do they do that?
Yeah, because they don't want to settle these cases. In many cases, they don't want to settle the cases. They don't want to get into that particular bucket of worms. And I can understand that. Because if they settle positively for one victim, they're opening up a Pandora's box, because then all the others who have been subjected to that same treatment are going to come in and all hell is going to break loose.
And I mean...
Wait on these things as long as possible. Nobody likes somebody who's upsetting the system. You see, the system is working for white folks. In this country, in the United States, white folks think the system is working for them. But right now, they're scared to death because it's perfectly obvious that within 30 years, white people will have become a numerical minority in the United States of America. In fact, Ben Rottenberg, who was an advisor to President of the United States and a member of the American Enterprise Institute, wrote a book called The Birth Dearth.
The Birth Dearth.
Yes, in which he says that the main problem confronting the United States today is that there are too few white babies being born in this country now. If we don't solve this problem and do it quickly, white people will be in the minority and this will no longer be a white man's land. Now just think about the sexism, the ageism, the racism, the ugliness of that statement. He says there are three things we can do to solve this problem. Number one, we can pay women to have babies as they have been doing in Western European nations for years. Then he says, and these are his words, not mine, unfortunately, the majority of those wanting to, we'd have to pay women of all colors not to have babies. We'd have to pay women of all colors to have babies, so that won't solve our problem. And the majority of those wanting to have babies would not be white, so we can't do that. That would increase the number of women of color, of babies other than white color groups. He says the second thing we could do is increase the number of legal immigrants allowed into this country every year. Then he says, unfortunately, the majority of those wanting to come to this country today are people of color, so we don't want to do that. Think Donald Trump and his immigration policies. The third thing he says we could do is remember that 60% of the fetuses that are aborted every year in this country are white. If we could keep that 60% alive, that would solve our birth dearth. Now, does that sound racist to you?
Yes, it does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this was a man, this man was an advisor to presidents of the United States.
And what was his name?
The Right to Life in this country, the Right to Life movement. The Right to Life movement in this country is about the right to white life.
I agree. I mean, the one thing is that, you know, for myself is I can give an example of something I faced. When I was living in Windsor, Ontario, Canada, one time I asked a girl out. And when I asked her out, what she said to me was, "I don't date your kind."
She said what?
That's what she said. "I don't date your kind."
Okay.
And it's like, no, the girl was actually Caucasian. She was Italian and Irish.
And what are you?
I'm actually Indian and African.
She doesn't date your kind. In other words, she doesn't date people that she knows are smarter than she is and had more experiences. Is that what she's telling you?
I guess so, yeah, probably. I mean, yeah,
that's the... You need to take it. You need to say, "I'm sorry. You have poor taste. You have my sympathy."
Exactly. You know, maybe next time I'll say that to someone. I mean, the one thing is that most of my ex-girlfriends have actually been white. And I have to tell you one thing is, you know what? I don't look at it through their color of their skin, but the content of their character, like Martin Luther King Jr. said.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But subconsciously, you are looking at the color of their skin. And if you aren't, you haven't been listening for the last... How old are you?
I'm 27.
You haven't been listening for the last 27 years. Because you have been conditioned to the myth of white superiority, just as white males or females have been conditioned to the myth of white superiority. In my country, and if it happens in my country, it's going to happen in your country within 15 minutes. And it happens in this country all the time. The standards of beauty in the United States of America have for 500 years been, for women, been tall, thin, leggy, big breasts, blonde hair, pale skin, and blue eyes. And we start that from, we start that prenatally in this country. Those are the standards of beauty that are projected onto people on a minute-by-minute basis. I don't know how anyone can just ignore that. I don't think you can.
No, it can't be ignored. In fact, where I live right now, I have to say that the majority of students at the University of Waterloo are of international students and they're of minorities. And one of the things that a former instructor told me was that when he taught mathematics, he said the white students were quite discriminatory to the Asian students due to the fact that they excelled in this area. Now, I wanted to ask as as well, because this brought a question to me, is how can inclusion be addressed to ensure that all students are included? And what kind of training do you recommend staff members go through to better educate themselves about this area of exclusion, because it happens a lot?
Well, the people who are being excluded know it's happening.
Yeah.
And when they look at the faculty and staff and don't see anybody who look like themselves, they recognize the fact that this is an institution that isn't inclusive. They look at the people at the top of the organization, and if they see only one color group and it's white, they know that the chances are pretty good that this isn't, they can talk inclusion, but what they're doing speaks so loudly that you can't hear what they say.
That's quite true. In fact, I've noticed as well, as a person, that when I was a student at Lambton College, we had to do an exercise where we were all blindfolded, and we had to go, and we were all taken to the Creations Fine Dining restaurant at Lambton College. We all went there to eat, and we were told that everyone's going to be blindfolded, and you're going to try to eat while you're blind.
Eat while you're what?
You're blindfolded, right? You know how with blind people they can't see, right?
All right.
So what this professor did was she blindfolded every student.
Right.
To see what it's like to be blind.
To see what it's like to be black, or to see what it's like to be blind?
The way to see that you're blind. Like, I mean, the thing is that the way to live like a blind person.
Okay, but wait a minute. You can. Do you think that people who have no sight, who are blind, don't learn racism?
I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Do you think that a blind person doesn't learn to be a racist?
I think anybody can be a racist.
Absolutely. If this one of your faculties is, you aren't able to use that, we can get you through all your other faculties.
Yes.
So that's a nice exercise.
Yes.
It lets them know how it feels to be a blind person walking into an eating establishment.
Yes.
But it doesn't let them know how it feels not to be allowed into that eating establishment because of the blindness of the people who are on it, who are working there.
I agree 100%. See, I have to...
They all got in, didn't they?
I'm sorry, what was that?
All the students in that group with the blindfolds on...
Yes.
...got into the restaurant, right?
That's true, yes.
Nobody stood at the door and said, I'm sorry, our tables are full.
That's true, yeah, that's very, very true. That's a very good point.
That's what happens to Native Canadians in your country, and that's what happens to people of the wrong color groups in my country on a daily basis.
Absolutely. It's almost like, ever seen that movie Rush Hour 3?
No.
On Rush Hour 3 one time, they were in Paris, France. Chris Tucker, Jackie Chan, they got in the car, and then the cab was like, get out, I don't drive your kind. And he was referring to Chris Tucker because he was black. And then he's like, my kind. And then he was like, well, we don't drive Americans.
Well, that probably really does happen, you know. I love it. I got into a cab in someplace in Western Canada and asked to go to the shop where the native persons sell that lovely bread that they eat. And the cab driver said to me and to the three people who were with me, you go in there white and you're going to come out black and blue. You don't want to eat in that restaurant. I said, what? He said, yeah. Right today I've got a lot of business because they just got their government checks. So today they'll be real busy there because these people are spending our tax money.
And this was in Western Canada, you said, that a cab driver told you that?
This was in, I can't remember the name of the city because of R.
Regina?
That's it. See, I had trouble saying that because it sounds like vagina. Sorry, but every time I think of that, I think how my kids, when they were little, laughed when I told them about anything going on in Regina. But anyway, in Regina, this cab driver said to us, my husband, myself, and the woman who was traveling with us, my lawyer, that you don't want to go over there. You go in there white and you come out black and blue. Those people, and then he went into this long tirade about these First Nations people who were getting their government checks that day. And I bit my tongue because I wanted to get to the restaurant. And my husband was jabbing me in the ribs because he wanted to get there safely. My lawyer kept looking at him like, can you control her? So we just went along to get along.
That's quite true. In fact, for myself, is that, you know what? I have to say that I met once a security guard that worked at St. Clair College. And this gentleman told me, and he's an older fella, just to let you know, he's a lot older than me, but he ended up telling me that anyone who tells you that is not prejudiced, they're lying to you.
They are. Of course they are. Except in many cases they aren't, because they really don't recognize prejudice. They really don't recognize racism unless you're wearing a Klan hood.
Yes, and that is quite true.
The most disgusting things. And you asked the question a few minutes ago about racism is more subtle. There's no such thing as subtle racism to the person who's on the receiving end of it. They recognize it immediately. And they have to decide whether they're going to confront it or whether they're just going to get through the day.
Absolutely. And the one thing is that I think when it comes to addressing racism, see, I hear all the time that, you know, when I was I know with Windsor Police, for example, and they have a thing where they say now we're going to hire a diversity officer to reflect our diversity of the population. But I mean, to recruit more minorities, it's a good thing. However, does it address the root causes of discrimination in the force? So, I mean, there's two questions to be answered, right?
Well, first, they seem to be admitting that there is no real acceptance for diversity in the force yet, because they aren't diverse yet. So that should tell you something right there. And then they're saying we're going to hire a person.
Yeah.
To increase our diversity. No, they should change and train every person on the force to increase their acceptance of those who are different from themselves. Not bring in someone to teach them how. Teach them as they are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And don't bring in one person who is responsible for changing the climate. It isn't going to happen.
Absolutely.
They're going to listen to it. They're going to figure, well, you're here to make us feel bad about ourselves, and we're not going to let you do that. So we're going to simply isolate you. And I know how that feels, because I've been isolated for the last almost 50 years because of what I do. Because I make people take another look at the things they're saying and doing, and the movies they're watching and the books they aren't reading. And it doesn't make people comfortable. They want somebody out there to solve this problem. They don't absolutely refuse to recognize that the problem isn't out there. It's within each one of us. After the age of 15, if you are still ignorant, where skin color is concerned, that is self-imposed ignorance, because there are hundreds and hundreds of books out there that will show you how wrong you are to treat people positively or negatively on the basis of physical characteristics over which they have no control.
Absolutely, and I totally agree with you. Now this is a interview with Police Sergeant Ren Dorsant. It's 1 minute and 50 seconds, so it's not that long, but he talks about this diversity position, and I just wanted to get your opinion on what you disagree with or agree with. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Diverse culture, and that is to change a culture from within. Not that the Windsor Police needs any great changing, but also to recruit other diverse community people to the Windsor Police, to identify those people, to create programs, network, friendships, building relationships, in making them receptive to the idea of policing as a career, and to get the best of the best that are out there, that are coming not only through colleges and university, but other walks of life as well. Well, that's going to take partnerships. That's going to take partnerships with diverse focus groups that are already out there and we've already made connections with. But we're going to strengthen those connections. And we're going to put the word out, of course, at our St. Clair College, as well as our University of Windsor.
Are you not hearing that well?
Yeah, I'm not hearing that well. You tell me what, you take the first sentence and tell me what he said.
Well, he's saying about, like, how he was saying that, you know, when it comes to, sorry about that, when it comes to building the relationships, for example, he was saying that when it comes to building relationships, that we want to strengthen those relationships. We want to be able to say that to come to policing as a career to minorities. And he was also saying as well that if I understood his context, which I actually do, is that he will develop training programs for Windsor police officers in the area of anti-racism, anti-discrimination, and cultural diversity. And this man is actually from Trinidad, and his parents, I think, came to Canada in 1948.
Okay. So he is saying that in order to decrease the level of racism in the police department, they have to retrain their police officers, but also, I would hope, the people who are hiring police officers.
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, he was saying about with reducing discrimination. And I know Chief Al Frederick, he was saying as well that when it comes to reducing discrimination, he said that we won't be able to eliminate it entirely.
We won't be able to eliminate it in its entirety.
We won't be able to eliminate it into its entirety, but we can raise awareness.
Yeah. Well, raising awareness is the first step. But making it difficult to discriminate is the first step. Having logical consequences for your unacceptable behaviors toward the citizenry that you're hired to protect, that's the first step.
Yes.
You have to see what those unacceptable behaviors and unacceptable words are.
That's true, yeah, exactly.
Someone there who's willing to write them down when they happen and document them and then say, go to the person who's doing it, and say, here's what I wrote down about you this week. These are the five things you did this week that are bound to turn off people of colors other than your own. We can't afford to have the local citizenry turned off by your attitudes and your behaviors. These behaviors have to stop. They have the right to say, and the responsibility to say, to police officers or the heads of departments, these are the behaviors that we want you to change. We want to see evidence of change. If these behaviors don't change, you will be saying to us, indirectly, that you don't like to work for this department.
Exactly, yeah.
I expect to see change. I expect to see measurable change in the next 6 weeks. I'll give you 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Then after that, we're going to have another meeting, and if this change hasn't come about, I'll give you 3 more weeks, and then after that, if there's no change, that says to me that you don't like working under these conditions or for this organization, and you'll be happier somewhere else.
Absolutely.
If superintendents and principals would do that with teachers, teachers would change their behaviors instantly. And if you think you can't create behavioral change, think about what happens when you've had the same an open street for years, and the police put up a stop sign halfway down that street. What does everybody do?
Stop.
They stop. Absolutely. Immediately. They stop. You can create change. You can put stop signs up where undesirable behaviors are being exhibited by people who are paid by your organization. And if they don't stop, that means they don't want to live within that organization and its rules. Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't, actually.
It doesn't?
What was that? I'm sorry. What doesn't make sense?
Does what I just said about stopping and behavioral change make sense to you?
It does. It does, actually. Yes, it does.
Yeah, well, then why aren't we doing it?
Well, the reason we're not doing it is because we're scared of our own power. That's what it is. We don't want to lose our power.
Yeah, well, you see, in 30 years, you'll be in the same shape that the United States is. And if power depends on acceptance of racism, you're going to lose your power.
That's true. And I think the thing is that I know for myself is I've noticed that in the last decade, from 2007 until now, 2016, almost one decade, I've noticed that the amount of racism has gotten worse.
I'll tell you why that's happened in the United States, and what happens in the United States happens in Canada instantly. The southern Members of Congress from the southern states were and have been and still are determined to see to it that Barack Obama, a black man in the White House, is not going to be successful. And they have, by their words and deeds, encouraged the lunatic fringe in this country to increase their ugly behaviors and their ugly attitudes and their ugly words. And that's the reason Dinosaur T. Rump has been nominated for the presidency of the United States, because of the backlash to angry white people at the presence of a black man in the White House. I remember when President Nixon said to a group of reporters, "I'm trying to save the White House for you white people." Think about that.
Yeah, that is a very racist comment.
I should think so. He's the President of the United States. And if it was all right for him to say it, then it's all right for Joe Blow, who works at the local foundries, to say it on the job. And it's all right for the coaches that taught in the school that I was teaching in to come to school on Monday morning after having watched Archie Bunker on Saturday night and say, "Boy, that Archie Bunker, he said," and then they go, "I wish I'd said that." And it was blatant racism, sexism, ageism, homophobia, ignorance. And he was their hero. It didn't occur to them that Norman Lear wrote that program as a cautionary tale. Here's how not to behave. They thought this was a show that showed all of us how to behave. And that's exactly what Southern members of the House of Representatives and the Tea Party people have been doing with our president. If it's all right for senators and members of the House of Representatives to behave in those ways, then why isn't it all right for teachers to say those things and to do those things and to think those things are right?
I totally agree. I mean, the one thing is that there is a double standard in society. Like, there's always going to be double standards, and it's a sad thing, because I mean, also as well, the other double standard I've actually found myself is, like, you know, like, one of the things is that, you know, here in Canada, one of the double standards that I found that's very, very common is, you know, when it comes to men and women and how men and women are treated. Yeah,
do you accept that?
I don't.
Well, many women do. What you will accept, you can expect.
Well, the one thing that I don't accept is the fact that, you know, I know that I don't accept when people are sexist towards females, and I also don't accept when women are sexist to men. I think it should be 100% an equal. Everything should be 100% equal.
Wait, it won't be 100% equal in perception until they are equal in power, and that isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
They're asking the people who have no power not to act like the people who have power act.
Yeah.
So if you want to stop people out of power from acting that way, change the model. Change the way the people who have power behave. Dictate the terms or dictate the behaviors.
And what ideas would you suggest? Just out of curiosity.
Well. See, I was a waitress at the Last Supper, so I've seen less stuff going on for a long time. You need to realize that.
Yes.
So I am looking at the world, a world where we learn nursery rhymes, which were sexist. Oh my God. I'm looking at my religion, in which we saw the pictures of the Holy Family on our Christmas cards.
Yes.
And Mary was always pale-skinned and blue-eyed with blonde hair, and Jesus always looked like a little Pillsbury doughboy.
Yes.
Well, they were all in the Middle East. They were born and raised in the Middle East. And it says in the Bible that Jesus had kinky, woolly hair and feet of bronze. So we say one thing, and we do another. We don't teach the truth. And we have twisted our relationships. Read Naomi Wolf's book. Oh, boy. She wrote about what life was like 10,000 years ago, before males took over. There was a time when males and females were seen as equal, equal partners and equal power. I can't remember the name of that book, but you look it up and you'll find it. And it's just a remarkable description of how this all happened. The same kinds of things happened to change the power structure 10,000 years ago, as have happened in the last 500 years in this country to change the power where blacks and where white people and other color groups are concerned. It's all about power. We have, if a woman acts like she has power, she's going to be called the V word.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for me, the B word is an acronym for being in total control, honey. And every time I am aggressive, or assertive, when I'm assertive, I'm called aggressive. When a man is aggressive, he's called assertive. The language says certain things and certain behaviors are respected and expected for both genders.
I 100% agree with your point, because I will say that, you know, personally, I've even told people that, let's say, if a woman is being assertive, she's called aggressive. And if a man is being aggressive, he's called assertive. I agree with that. That makes perfect sense. In fact, I have to say that, you know, a lot of people have called me, a lot of people, like, I mean, like when it comes to the description of my personality, I've had two people tell me in this city, like in Kitchener-Waterloo, and I'm talking, they're my friends, but also I met these two people on the job. So what these two people told me was that I'm assertive. And I mean, I've had other people tell me I'm not assertive. So I guess there's this varying degree of perception.
But what you have to remember is what they say about you or think about you doesn't have to affect you in the least. That's their problem. If I worried the last 6 years about what people were saying and thinking about me, I would have shriveled up and crawled into a hole. If I had allowed them and their opinions and their words to change my behaviors or my belief in the rightness or wrongness of what I was doing, what I was hearing, what I was saying. You don't allow other people and their perception of you to dictate your life.
I agree.
Another thing you need to realize, not everybody's thinking about you. Very few people are thinking about you. Most of them are thinking about themselves. Most of the time you spend thinking about yourself, you don't spend thinking about other people.
Mm-hmm.
But we are constantly, some of us are constantly wondering, what are people going to say about this? What are people thinking about me? Get over it. They aren't thinking about you. Everybody else has their own problems. Get over it. You know, I just, everybody should read the book, The Four Agreements. I can't remember the author's name.
Oh, Don Miguel Ruiz. I have a copy of that book.
That's it. Take nothing personally. Do your best. Be impeccable with your word. And what's the fourth one?
You know what? Yeah, be respectful with your word. Don't take anything personally. Always do your best. And there's a fourth one in there. I'll just quickly...
See, but I can always name three, but I can't name the fourth.
The four...
Take nothing personally is the third one that's most important, as far as I'm concerned. If people are saying ugly things, don't take it personally. Figure, well, they have a problem.
That's
got to be mine.
Don't make assumptions.
Make no assumptions. Don't assume that people are thinking about you, because they aren't. Most people aren't thinking about you. They're thinking about how they're going to make enough money to pay the bills this month.
Exactly. I mean, yes. And I have to say that Don Miguel Ruiz wrote, you will need a very strong will in order to adapt the four agreements. But if you can begin to live your life with these agreements, the transformation in your life will be amazing. You will see the drama of hell disappear right before your eyes. Instead of living in a drama of hell, you'll be creating a new dream, your personal dream of heaven.
Right. And I don't put it in terms of hell and heaven. I put it in terms of comfort and discomfort. You want to be uncomfortable all your life? Let other people and their perceptions of you dictate your life and how you feel about yourself. If you want to be uncomfortable, they'll help you do that. But they won't even know that they've done it, because they're so uncomfortable themselves But they aren't paying attention to whether to your comfort level.
That's true, and I have to say that, yes, it's comfort or uncomfort, because what I find with, when it comes to, let's say, for example, for myself is, my parents have told me that, that when it comes to what people think about me and stuff, let's say if I was not behaving myself or not behaving appropriately, they're like, this person's looking at you, this person is judging you. It's like, I don't care.
What's the difference? If they're judging you, it's because they don't have enough to think about. If they have time to think about you, they don't have enough on their mind. Anyway, their thoughts aren't the problem. Think what you want to about me, but change your behaviors toward me. You can think in ugly ways about me if you choose to, but you better treat me fairly whether you like me or not.
Exactly. No, and I totally agree with that. And I'm going to end on with this last quote that I wanted to share as well. It's from Don Miguel Ruiz, and he says, when you transform your whole dream, magic just happened in your life. What you need comes to you easily because spirit moves freely through you. This is the mastery of intent, the mastery of spirit, the mastery of love, the mastery of gratitude, and the mastery of life. This is the goal of the Tolek. This is the path of personal freedom.
Well, you see, I don't necessarily believe that love is that big a deal. I think that justice is a big deal.
I agree. I totally agree. Justice is more
for me. And you don't treat me justly, then we are going to end up loving one another, because I'm not going to treat you justly if you don't treat me justly.
Exactly. You know what? Everything that people write can be questioned. It's always true. And I mean, I love that. I love it that, that we live in a free and democratic society like Canada and the U.S. where we can challenge or even question one's opinions and talk about it. I love that.
Well, some of us live in a free and democratic society.
Yeah.
Others of us live in the land of the free.
Yeah.
Some of us white folks live in the land of the free.
Yes.
People of color, in your country and mine, live in the home of the brave.
Yes. So the home of the brave. So I guess, what does that mean, home of the brave?
It means that people of color have to be brave to get out of bed in the morning and walk out of the door in the United States of America.
And that's the same thing in Canada, too. I feel that way, too, some days. Like, I find when I've looked for jobs... Like right now, I'm not working right now. But what I find is that when I'm looking for work, putting my resumes out, putting myself out there, I feel as though that I have a harder time looking for a job sometimes. And I think it has to do.
You have a harder time looking for one, but you have a harder time finding one.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. But we talk about the United States. Talk about the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yes.
We have two countries. We have a free country. And we have a country in which people have to be brave. Because we are riddled. This country is permeated with the lie of white superiority and racism. Until we get over that, we will not truly be in a free country. Only half of us will be free.
Absolutely. It's almost like with our school system in the Waterloo region with their public school system where they came under fire for not having enough minorities in management.
Makes sense to me.
And this is I think this is like the third largest diverse city and that's still the case. That's pretty sad though.
Well, what that's telling you is that white folks are slow learners. We should have learned a long time ago that we're living a lie. We should have given it up a long time ago. But to some of us, it feels good, and it doesn't enter our heads that not all of us are getting the same feeling in your country and mine.
Absolutely. Now, when you went around the world and you taught these exercises, which country did you find where people learned the quickest in recognizing discrimination and biases?
Oh, I don't know.
I'm trying to
think of one where they didn't resist, and I can't think of one. You have to take a look at the film Indecent Exposure that we did in Regina.
Yes.
Take a look at that. If you haven't seen it, take a look at it.
Indecent Exposure?
There's a little resistance there. Take a look at the one that we did in Australia called So am I.
So am I, okay.
A little resistance there. Just unbelievable. Look at the one we did in London for the BBC. But when you look at that, remember that most of the participants, many of the participants in that one were paid actors, paid to come in and sabotage the exercise. But look at their behaviors. Look, there's a white woman in there who says she's been a teacher for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And one day she went out on the playground to help a little black girl who had gotten cut. Mm-hmm. And she was surprised to see that that child was pink under the skin just like the rest of us.
And you know what? I saw both of these documentaries. I mean, sorry, I saw the one for England. I don't think I saw the one for Australia. But
so I'm... That, one, that teacher who said that was not hired to say that. That came out of her own mouth and out of her own thoughts and out of her own behavior and her own memories. Now, you think of the racism in that statement and in that thought.
That is a very racist statement.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And if she didn't lose her job the day after that film was shown on the BBC, then there's something wrong with the school in which she teaches. Because it says it's okay to say those things and think those things about our students of color who are other than white.
I agree. And I have to say as well that now have you ever done any exercises in Canada?
Yeah, well, Regina. Isn't Regina in Canada?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I sure have. And I worked for 1 year, well, two weeks out of my life, I worked for the Royal Bank of Canada, and we started on the East Coast and hit every major city in which there was a Royal Bank of Canada, from the East Coast to the West Coast of Canada. Absolutely fascinating. One of the easiest experiences I ever had, and one of the pleasantest experiences I ever had. But I find that people who are, or who is mandated to listen to me, behave well.
Mm-hmm.
Those who have a choice don't behave quite so well.
No, and I agree, absolutely. And the one thing is that so you did an exercise with the Royal Bank of Canada. Was there any other companies you actually did exercises with, or schools in Canada?
No, the film that we did for whichever film company it was. But I have had, for the most part, nothing but really positive experiences with Canadians, unless I mention their groups of color. And then white folks tend to get a little stressed out. But you have to realize that people who come to the United States, people of color, particularly blacks, who come to the United States from Canada, have been treated much more fairly than have those who are native to the United States. Blacks who have been born, raised, and schooled in the United States of America are under a whole lot more stress, it seems to me, and have a lot more ugly experiences than blacks who are in Canada. I don't think the same thing is true for the First Nations people.
Yeah, I know what the First Nations people, they get treated a lot worse. They're
It's absolutely unacceptable. It's absolutely unacceptable.
And I totally agree. I mean, the one thing is that the murder and missing of Aboriginal women, you know, there needs to be a public inquiry on that, and I don't think that's happened yet. There needs to be...
another thing I have to remember is the population of Canada, the entire country, is equal to the population of California.
That's true.
And think of the difference in the landmass.
Yeah, we got a much larger landmass than California.
Yeah, huge. As Dinosaurus T. Rump would say, huge. But it isn't about density of population.
Yes.
You can't blame it on that. You have to look for another reason in Canada. And it's the same reason that we have in the United States, which is ignorance. Self-imposed ignorance after the age of 15. Refusal to learn about those who are different from yourself because the society doesn't require that you know about those who are other than white.
And I 100% agree with that. In fact, I have to say as well that in Canada, I did some research to see if any Canadian news or television networks have interviewed you. And I have to say that not very... I think I'm the first one...
The CBC did a film in my classroom there was the first group that filmed in my classroom in 1969. Nobody was in my classroom with cameras the first year I did the exercise, the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. The following, and that was in April, the following October, the CBC, with Stephen Banker, filmed the exercise in my classroom. And that three days of filming that they did, they took to Canada, edited it down to half an hour, and threw it into the middle of a program about Eskimos. And something called The Week That Was.
Yes.
EW3, I believe it was called.
Yes.
And at that time, they were calling Eskimos in Canada, according to film crew members, they were calling Eskimos in Canada niggers and parkas. And they threw that film into the middle of that program. You need to take a look at that interview.
And what is that called? Let me jot that down.
It was called The Week That Was. I think it was TW3.
Yeah, The Weeks It Was.
Yeah, and
TW3.
Yeah, see, and it would have been in 1969, the fall of 1969, I believe.
1969.
It was the October after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed in April. So 1968, it would have been 1968. He was killed on April 4th of 1968. Yeah, it was 1968, and they came in and filmed in my classroom that fall in October. Sent a film crew. With Stephen Banker as the person who produced the thing. And you've got to see it because it's just, they film live students, and then because they are such a furor when they put that on television, people, their switchboard went crazy. So they called me and asked me if I would come up and be interviewed by the CBC on site. So I went to Toronto, I went into the studio, and there's a little dais on the floor, and around that dais is a set of whatever you call it, people sitting in a studio arrangement around that dais. And I pointed at the dais and I said, "What's that?" And the person who's going to do the interview said, "That's where you're going to sit." I said, "Who are they?" And he said, "Those are the people who have come here to interview you." So I said, "This looks like a setup." He said, "It is." He took my arm, led me out, sat me on one of the chairs on that desk and said, "Folks, are there any questions? This is Jane Elliott. She has come here to talk to you about the exercise she did with her third graders, her blue-eyed, brown-eyed exercise. Anybody have a question?" Practically every one of those people raised their hands and commenced to ask me what in hell I thought I was doing those poor little white children in Riceville, Iowa. take a look at that interview. And if you can get a copy of it, I'd like to have a copy of it.
Or you'd like to have a copy of it if I can find it.
Yeah, if you can find it, I'd like to see it.
Absolutely, because the one thing is that I know for myself is I accidentally wrote that I was the first one to interview you because I could not find any information because it was just, I put Jane Elliott Canada and it didn't really give me much, right? I looked in the Wikipedia and everything.
He was the first one. I'm thinking his name was Walt or something, maybe. I can't remember the name of the interviewer. But I was just amazed. Almost the first person that asked the question. A white woman, we should have known better, stood up and said, "Don't you think you could do grave psychological damage to a child by using that exercise with them for a day?" And I said something to the effect of, "Well, if you're upset about that, you must be really unhappy about what happens to children of color." I probably said colored children in your environment. And she said, "That's different. They're used to it. They can take it."
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, and I have to say that, and what school was this done at?
It wasn't done at a school, but CBC sent somebody to film the exercise.
Oh, they filmed the exercise.
October of 1968. And then, after it was shown on television, on like Sunday night maybe, this place went crazy.
Yeah.
So they called me to come up the next Saturday, must have been 2 or 3 weeks later, to explain to the people in Canada what I had done to those poor little children in Iowa.
What?
The interview was to last for an hour. And I think it lasted for about three. I'm not sure if it did go on and on and on.
Well,
absolutely amazing.
Well, I have to say, you're a pretty nice person. I gotta say, it's just, I have to say that when you deliver the exercises, I know you have a no-nonsense approach, and I actually like that. You know what? I wish more teachers were like that. Like, you're empathetic, you're good to the students, you're kind. I even saw The Eye of the Storm, and I saw how courteous you were with the students, and I wish we had more teachers like you, but you were fair.
But you see, what I did with the students on the day of that exercise, those days, is what we do, we fair, loving teachers do, with children of color, every day in your country and mine.
Yeah.
But what I do with the exercise is create a microcosm of society in a group. And if it looks insane, it's because society is insane. To treat people positively or negatively on the basis of physical characteristics over which they have no control, and to do it for centuries and expect to get different results, that is what alcoholics refer to as insanity. Doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results is insane. And that's what we're doing in your country and mine, where education is concerned.
Absolutely, and it's like it seems as though no matter how many lawsuits and stuff that have happened in this country as well, it seems like people just don't learn.
They choose not to learn.
Yeah.
Not that they can't, it's that they choose not to.
Yeah.
That's a choice we make.
Yeah.
We can choose to be fully functioning human beings, and regard other human beings as fully functioning human beings.
Yeah.
Or we can continue to think that there are superior beings and inferior beings, and that status is determined by skin color. How ridiculous can that be? How much dumber can we get?
See, I remembered one time I was taking a public transit bus, like I was taking a city bus. And I was saying that I don't like the way that people treat me, and I have no choice but to give an attitude or whatever. And you know what this one driver told me? She's like, everybody's got a choice. It's your choice on how to react.
On that bus, and the people running that system and the people sitting in that driver's seat had a choice too. She had a choice.
Yeah.
She had a choice to expect people on that bus to not only pay the fare, but to behave in a fair way. There are fares and fares.
Yes.
Was that a public bus?
It was a public transit, yes. It was Grand River Transit.
Public transit?
Yeah.
Owned by the taxpayers indirectly and paid out of taxpayer funds.
That's right, yes.
And everybody who gets on that bus has the right to expect equitable treatment under the law. That's in our Constitution. It might not be in your Constitution, but I'll bet it's in that bus company's bylaws.
Absolutely, and it's like
standard dictated by the company, and I'll bet that is one of the requirements for employment, which they disregard or ignore.
And I asked, I remembered I interviewed Eric Gillespie from the Grand River Transit, and I asked him, if you go on soundfm.ca, you'll see the interview that I had with the GRT director, Eric Gillespie, and I asked him if they actually do human rights training, when it comes to the Ontario Human Rights Code, like the TTC, the Toronto Transit Commission, they expect all of their employees to have an interpretation of the Ontario Human Rights Code, and they give training on that. And the thing about...
They do it once a year and they tick the box.
Sorry?
They do it once a year and they tick the box.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I've had people from some corporations all over the country and many places call me and say, we need you to come to our place of business to help our employees. And I say, and how long do you expect me to be there? Well, from half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour max. I say, and you are going to solve your inclusive problems, your inclusion problems, in half an hour once a year. Well, Mrs. Elliott, I guess we might not need you. And I say, yeah, you need me, but you don't want me.
You know what? Maybe I should convince our city councilors and stuff to bring you along for their training.
Yeah, oh, you could. But, you see, you'd have to have a security officer on property at all times, because I've been threatened with death so often that it's just getting really quite ridiculous.
And I'm sorry to hear that. Nobody should ever do that.
Hey, that's not a problem. It used to bother me a lot. I used to take out a life insurance policy and a disability insurance policy because of the danger. I don't do that anymore. My husband died 2.5 years ago. And I figured, hey, fool, if you want to do me in now, that's right. Be my guest.
I'm sorry to hear that you lost your husband.
Well, I didn't lose him. He died. It's not just losing, that's all. Anyway, let's get moved. Okay, are we done?
Yes, I'm done. Thank you so much for coming on to my, talking with me on the show, and I will definitely air this interview today. Like, I'm just going to go ahead and process this and air it on, and I'm also just going to say that I guess I'm the second person to have interviewed you out of any Canadian television or radio newscast.
No, you aren't. You're about the 10th.
I'm actually the 10th? Okay, that's great. Then I will make sure that I'll update that.
Okay, that's fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. That was Jane Elliott. She is a anti-racism activist. And check out her interview. I am the 10th person to speak to her in regards to this. Have a great day.